King Lear has just opened at the West Yorkshire Playhouse with Tim Pigott-Smith as the beleaguered monarch. The director is Ian Brown, artistic director here since 2002. My name's Heather Neal, and Ian's made time to talk to Theatre Voice about the production. Well, you've staged plays of all kinds and periods over the past decade, from Eightbourn to Miller, Privates on Parade to The Secret Garden, but you frequently return to Shakespeare. Is Lear the toughest of them all to put on?
Weirdly, it was the toughest, I think, to get to know really well. I was a bit daunted by it because it's such a massive text. There are two versions of the play, which is quite confusing. There's the quarto and the folio. Yes. The folio is a revised version of the quarto. They have different things in each version, so it means that if you put them both together, you've got a really huge, sprawling script. So it's quite important to decide which version you're going to do and which bits of the version you're going to do, and then not make it too long.
Yes, and one is called a history and one a tragedy. So is that something you had to make your mind up about as well?
I didn't really get hung up on that, really. Tim Pigott-Smith and I worked on it together, and we wanted to tell a sort of fast-moving story. We didn't want to burden a 21st century audience with lots of things that, on a first hearing, you're really not going to understand. So we have done a cut version, but we have used some bits from both versions.
Yes.
And we wanted to tell an exciting story, which I think we've managed
to do. Has obvious resonances for us, doesn't it? Apart from the bleakness of things that happened, there's also the fact that it was written just after James came to the throne, two or three years after he came to the throne, and was holding the country together. And we're seeing something similar now with people going in different directions.
It was written at a time of unrest, and I suppose that does echo in the play and for now. There's a moral lesson about being a good king and being a good leader, and I think we probably are feeling that we would like to be led well, and not sure if we are being led well or whether or not it's just a sort of PR stunt. Interesting, you know, we have a big debate this week about, you know, whether Ed Miliband can successfully lead the Labour Party and presumably the next government if that was to come to pass.
Yeah.
And will Edgar, at the end of the play, make a good king?
Yes.
Not at all certain, I would say.
No, not at all certain. We're kind of left without anything being very certain, except we have seen love achieved, at any rate. That's real love discovered.
Yes, the play is quite a cruel play, obviously, but there are small acts and, well, potentially quite big acts of kindness in it too, and they're very, very important, I think. And there's the debate about whether or not you should see the world with a glass half full or glass half empty, which is sort of Edgar's mission with poor old Gloucester. And I think even he feels a little bit bad that he allowed his
father. Is that how you explain his what seems rather cruel testing of him, when he makes him apparently jump off the cliff when he's not anywhere near the cliff?
It's to make him value life, and Gloucester continually learns the lesson about valuing life, and then almost immediately he's done that, just starts to despair again and want to end it all.
And of course he dies when he does learn the whole truth.
Yeah, because his journey is so interesting, I think, in the play, because we start the play with Gloucester boasting about his sexual exploits, and it's a theme that runs right through the play about whether or not it's right to have an affair outside of your marriage bed, and the result, you know, the bastard son, and what happens because of this bastard son. So this night of lovemaking ends up with his downfall, which is amazing, isn't it?
It is, yes. put like that.
And also that first scene it sets the tone for the whole play, and most productions I've seen sort of skip over that scene as like it's not really important.
Yes, get on to the court.
When Gloucester and Kent are talking about who the king prefers, and then introducing Edmund. But it's crucial, and it gets the audience. There's some laughter in it, and it gets the audience laughing quite early on in the play, which is brilliant.
Yes, well, your casting of James Garland as Edmund is a very interesting one, because he's someone who's done a lot at the Globe and is used to addressing the audience directly, which indeed. He does in this production. I'd forgotten how much Edmund actually does that. But, however, I was interested that you didn't allow him any redemption at the end, because usually his changing of the order to save, he usually hopes, to save Cordelia at the end is subverted here, isn't it?
It is subverted. It's Jimmy's choice, in a way, to do that, and I think it works really well, actually, because I never quite believed Edmund's sudden... change of heart and suddenly becoming trying to do the decent thing. So he sort of does the decent thing, but in a very insulting way, and he leaves the stage very, very aggressively. That's actually got a little bit more aggressive recently.
Yes, he pulls himself up and then laughs in their face.
Yeah, it's a very dramatic end, I think,
it does
make that quite an interesting moment, I think, as to what Edgar's left with as well, just the humanity that's kind of exposed or not exposed by his.
Yes, because he's required to change so much, because he's sort of a bit of a geek at the beginning, isn't he? A sort of scholarly type who isn't very interested in the politics.
He's Ed Miliband, you see. Yeah, as I said to Sam, who's playing Edgar,
this is Sam Crane.
I said, I think he's Ed Miliband, really. There's a sort of seriousness of purpose which doesn't sit well with the cut and thrust of the politics of the time. But, Ed Miliband is a serious intellectual guy with some interesting things to say and to do. But he comes over in this kind of media age as a geek.
Yes, well, let's hope he doesn't actually kill David.
It was fairly Lear-like plot, wasn't it, really? Just two brothers to stand against each other is pretty, just disturbing thing to do, really.
Yes, well, he ends up having had to pretend to be mad and living the life of a bedlam beggar, seen what's happened to his father, observed his father's death, and then killed his brother, and now he's got to, he says, tell the story.
I think he's also driven mad, I think, by
the picture of him pretending to be mad at the same time as we see Leo going mad.
I think he's going mad as well. I think he goes through a period of madness, and then I think seeing Gloucester blinded brings him to and realises that he's got to snap out of it and perhaps do something, take some action. But I think because he is rejected by his father, and in rehearsals we talked about possibly Gloucester actually getting on better with Edmund, that actually he could go down the pub and have a drink with Edmund, whereas he couldn't do that with Edgar.
But I
do think, the way that Gloucester believes all that badness about him, it just sends him over the edge, really. And we also talked about the fact that people in those positions do have enemies. And so when Edmund tells him, I think his first line is, some villain have done me wrong. And I think it's very believable that he would know somebody that could do him wrong, that he's made some enemies.
Yes, and of course Shakespeare was writing in a time when that was happening around him. So,
definitely, full of intrigue and backstabbing and all the rest of it.
Well, I think we should say something about the design, because the first half of the play is dominated by an extraordinary tilted sort of room. So we are made to see immediately that the world is out of joint, as it were, to come from another play. Mm. That things are out of kilter, things are not right. But then the design's by Rory Murchison. But in the second half, it's much simpler. What was your thinking there?
Well, trying to get the best of both worlds, really, because my original idea was pretty much do it on a bare stage. Mm. And there are some complications in the first act as to where they are. And also we have the challenge of the storm and how to stage that. And because most of the scenes in Act 1 are at somebody's palace or other, the original idea was to have this sort of box that could represent Gloucester's house or Goneril's house or Lear's palace. And we were going to move it a little bit more than we actually do, but it was on a revolve. But we just have given it sort of some kind of background setting, really. And you're right about the off-kilter nature of it. It gives a sort of momentum to that first act. And then in the second act, we did the thing that I really wanted to do in the first place, which was to get rid of everything. And it's a fantastic thing for the audience, I think. They come in, they go, wow, where did that huge thing... Because it is, it weighs 7 tons.
The person sitting next to me actually said, where's it gone?
I know, it weighs 7 tons, that thing.
Oh, my goodness.
And the floor of the box becomes part of the floor of the half moon, right. So it's quite ecologically designed.
So we've got a huge moon above the above the set, and then we've got a sort of half moon floor reflecting that.
The planetary influence on the play that's referenced right from the very beginning with the eclipse, and the eclipse
which we see
are referenced. I thought that was really strong, and I really wanted to sort of highlight that. And I think you see these human beings under the planets, if you like, sort of just poor naked wretches, kind of just trying to make their way in the world under a sort of unforgiving and uncaring universe, really. And I think the stars are referenced quite a lot, actually. And one of my favourite bits is when the Fool and Lear look up at the stars and look at the Great Bear in the sky and wonder why there are 7 stars and not 8. And it's a lovely moment, I think, when human beings look up and realise how small we are.
Yeah. Yes. That's very, very clear in the first part. Also, when Lear says blow at the beginning of the storm, crack cheeks, it's you have him high up, so he looks a bit like a fly, sort of trapped.
I think there's a bit of an Old Testament image for me up there as well. He feels like a sort of, I don't know, some one of those figures at the corner of a map, maybe blowing, and... I think he's having a conversation with the gods, because he's a king and he's able to sort of feel that they're listening to him more than perhaps they're listening to ordinary human beings. But it's a challenging scene, I think, the storm anyway.
Yes.
And we wanted to make it quite dramatic, but we also wanted to use the theatricality of it, because it's impossible to stage a storm, really.
Yes, and so you have a sort of thunder machine in view.
Yeah. I just made a decision not to go with real rain either, just because it just never works for me. And we did try another effect, but actually I thought, let's try and be honest about it, but also have this kind of human-made percussion.
Yeah.
So that's how we do it, really. And
the word nothing, of course, is an important word in the play. It's what Cordelia says, and it resonates through the play. And you make that very clear, don't you? The word nothing, you sort of highlight for us.
I think it's the use of language in the play is phenomenal, actually. And it's one of those wonderful things. You think, how did Shakespeare kind of have these frames of reference? And the imagery in the play is very strong. And the word nothing and never. I think that's just so interesting, and the nihilistic sort of aspect of the play speaks very powerfully to me. And I don't know, I just wanted to highlight that. I wanted the audience to sort of get some of those things, to think about it.
Yes, the audience reaction was actually very interesting. There was quite a lot of surprise and shock, I felt, around me.
Yes, well, I think often the story of King Lear gets a bit obscured by the fact that you're watching a sort of star performance by a posh actor. And the way Tim is, and the way he worked with the company, was that, you know, everybody in the company was equally valued. Yes, he was playing King Lear, but everybody else's story was very important too. And I think in Shakespeare that's really important, that you almost need the smaller parts as well played as the central part, and quite often that's not what happens, because some of those smaller parts are actually very, very difficult to judge and get right. And if you can do it, and it was written for a company of actors in the first place, so they would have all been played really, really well. And I think you just get this amazingly exciting story.
Mm.
And I think there are real surprises because people just haven't seen some of it before.
Yes, yes, it's very clear.
Yeah.
You've wanted to work with Tim for a while, I think, haven't you?
Yeah, we worked together a long time ago on a Sheila Stevenson play called Five Kinds of Silence, yes, which we did at the Lyric in Hammersmith. And we got on really well, and I always thought he'd be somebody I'd like to do something else with, and we'd kind of meet up every so often and talk about things. And then we just started to discuss this, and the idea of Leah came out of that. And so we've been planning it for about 2 years, I suppose.
Mm. Yes, it's difficult to cast because he actually says he's over 80, but it couldn't possibly be managed by him.
Well, he says that, but he is also not in his perfect mind when he says that. So, and he says 80, not an hour less, so it's not very accurate, I think.
Yes.
He's got to be old enough to have two daughters who are able to be childbearing. Otherwise, that doesn't make sense when he curses Goneril. So to play him too old is unhelpful, I think.
Yes, you've talked a little bit about what the relationship might have been between Gloucester and his sons. Did you talk about home life at the Lears?
Well, we did, actually, and I think what we decided was that the mother obviously died after Cordelia was born, and I think poor Goneril suffers most as a result of not being born a boy. And at a time probably when Leah was busy being a king and fighting battles and not having much time at home, and so she was neglected. Then Regan came, and the pressure on her to be a boy was not quite the same. And I think she, as a character, seems to have a way of playing him and making him feel more comfortable. I think Goneril by this stage is probably quite a tricky child. And then, of course, Cordelia comes along and becomes the apple of an eye, which is often what happens. And
and you actually have her entering with Leah on his arm, so it's quite clear from the beginning.
And there's a lot of sibling rivalry going on. I mean, they're just not a functional family. And I think three sisters can be quite tricky little relationships if you're not careful.
Yeah.
There is a hint, I don't know, there's definitely a sort of sexual thing, perhaps, with Leah and Goneril. You can't help thinking that.
With Goneril? Mm. Oh, because often people make it with Regan, don't
they? Yeah, I mean, there's definitely sort of something unhealthy in his attitude to women.
Yes.
And he does have a very, very twisted attitude to women and womankind. And the play is a bit of an exploration about what happens if women are evil as opposed to men being evil. And there is, I think, even in our culture, something particularly repellent about women doing evil, because we look to women to save us flawed men.
Yeah.
And so when they behave like men, we're very shocked by it.
His curses are truly horrible,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, they are. They really are. And that's partly one of the decisions to play Goneril younger, because... That really needs to sink in. That's a terrible thing to say to your daughter, who might be wanting a child. There is no child. Presumably, they would want one or wanted one.
Yes. Well, the daughters are sexually confused as well, especially Regan and Cornwall, who are excited by the blinding. Yes, I've seen that done before, but what was... You're thinking about this, is it that violence and sex are very much bound up for them?
Well, we did do a little bit of sort of research, and I know Hedith, who plays Regan, was very interested about women who do evil and how bound up they are often with the man.
Yeah.
So the Fred and Rosemary.
The Wests.
Wests, for example, you know, and Myra Hindley and all of that. So there is a sort of history of men and women working together.
Yes.
And
yet both the women take an initiative when it comes to Edmund, don't they?
Yes. Yes. I mean, the play starts to get a little bit sketched in at this point as to what they're doing. But you can understand why there is this sexual jealousy. He is obviously very sexually charismatic. And they're both... sort of available, and so he's just the match. So there's this terrible competition that goes on.
Yes,
those are the hardest scenes, I think, to stage, those scenes, because the text just is so stripped back by that stage.
It's very easy to get laughs.
Yeah,
I noticed that for the first time ever, I think, there wasn't a laugh on "Oh, the difference between man and man," because she went on very quickly to the next line. That was deliberate.
It's nice that I think the audience take it all quite seriously and get quite involved in it. I mean, they're quite shocked, I think, when Goneril does make her play for Edmund. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And then he subverts that too by his little look to Oswald, which is quite an interesting moment. Hmm. You can see what he's doing as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You've introduced something else there, haven't you?
Because the Oswald character is an interesting little sort of, you know, that he plotted the smaller characters very well in Lear, better than in some of his plays, because they do have a sort of through line, and Oswald does have a beginning and a middle and an end, and he ups the stakes in terms of what's going on with Goneril and her husband, and, you know, whether or not he's, how intimate he is with Goneril as well.
And Edmund can manipulate anybody.
Yes.
And make anybody fall in love with him.
You feel a bit sorry, weirdly, for Oswald, that he gets quite so duped, really, and he loses out to Edmund.
Yeah.
No, I feel really sorry for him. Just a little bit.
Perhaps we should just say something about the design of the costume, because you have a sort of the women have a sort of Elizabethan outline, don't they, in their dress, but it isn't otherwise Elizabethan. So is that a way of being modern and not modern at the same time?
Yeah, it is, really. I didn't want to do it a modern dress production, and it is a problem about where you set it. I've become more interested recently about staging it within the period that it was written, because it seems
you have to have a sword fight at the
end. And it does. It gets, you know, gets you over some of those issues. But obviously, you don't want it to be slavishly costumed. But I like them being in, if you like, sort of a version of Jacobean Elizabethan dress. I think that gives it a lot of weight and power. And there is a sort of fairy tale element of King Lear, and looking at it on the stage, I sort of feel we've captured some of that. It feels like a mythic story. It's not totally real. We've talked a lot about in rehearsals. You know, it's not really real. It's sort of dealing with real emotions, but actually it's very stylized, the whole play.
Don't you think that this is something that's happening more lately? I feel it, that we're moving away from straightforward psychoanalysis of the characters in Shakespeare to seeing them as kind of representational.
Well, to me, the language is very, very important. You know, so I feel that the text is obviously a challenge for a 21st century audience not used, and Shakespeare's language is very, very complex, more complex than, you know, we are generally used to, and a challenge for all of us, even if we've studied it and have worked on it a lot, it's still a challenge. So to bring to make the text kind of quite central and to let things flow from that, that gives you already a sort of stylized, almost artificial, poetic world that it's inhabiting. You know, it's dealing with images and symbols and archetypes, but within that there is a reality, and it is the most amazing play that looks at the human condition and how we live our lives and the bleakness that can be there in people's lives. So
yes, well, one person we haven't said very much about is Lear himself.
Exactly, quite interesting.
But clearly you saw characteristics in Tim that you thought you could bring out for this, your idea of
Well, I think I thought his energy was really useful, and that partly is the age that he is to play Lear. He's obviously a very experienced Shakespearean actor. I think he's brought great humanity to it. And I think you really, all the kind of different facets of Lear's journey through the play, the madness, the wrath, the vindictiveness, the pettiness, the laddishness, all of those things you've got to sort of find. And great sensitivity, actually, and the terrible things that he learns and how he becomes a better human being as a result of what happens to him. But that needs an actor with range, and Tim certainly has that.
Yeah.
And I think because we have tried to sort of see it a little bit as an ensemble piece, the character of Lear becomes not just a central character, but he is that it's the stage is shared by other people. So Gloucester's story, I think, is quite strong in it, and I think it's the stronger play for that. It's not just all about Lear; it is about all the other characters. You sort of get to know them and follow all their journeys, and they all have different journeys. It's very well plotted, and the Lear plot and the Gloucester plot and how they echo each other and converge is really brilliantly done, actually. So I think he brings this humanity, and it's very moving.
Yeah.
I think.
Yes, the ending is very moving.
Very simple,
the death
very
of
yeah.
Cordelia,
yeah.
Played by someone who has just left drama school.
Yeah,
that's Olivia Morgan.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lovely performance. I think she has a really beautiful quality, and I have to say, saw quite a few people to play Cordelia, but she just had something about her that I thought would just light up the stage, really. And I think everybody remembers Cordelia, and yet she has, fairly short scenes. She doesn't say a lot, but she's such an important character.
Yes. She has a toughness, though.
Yeah.
She's not just a sweet girl.
She's come back to fight, actually, and lead an army.
Exactly.
And
But you believe that in this performance,
good.
Because
she
could see that it was possible from the beginning.
Yeah, no, I like that. I think, and I felt she was. She interesting. The language gets quite biblical around her. I go about my father's business, has obvious echoes of the Bible, of which there's a lot in every Shakespeare play. But I sort of saw her as a Joan of Arc figure in a way. There was something about her sacrifice too, and her learning what she did wrong as well, and how sorry she is. Because it's all her fault.
In earlier versions, she did actually become queen, didn't she?
Yeah, I think so. Well,
I
think in the Victorian times they rewrote it, didn't they?
Oh,
so it had a happy ending.
Well, yeah.
Didn't she marry Edgar?
Oh, yes.
Or something like
but
that.
I mean, in the early story, she became queen.
It's an amazing thing that Shakespeare did to kill her off as well. I mean, it's an amazing, terrible thing that she dies.
Yes.
And you don't see her again.
It's
a very merry.
Johnson.
Well, we worked out that Edmund's got a bit of a thing about Cordelia. He's the daughter that he really wanted, and she would never have anything to do with him. So that's why he wants to kill her.
Oh my goodness! I've never thought of that one before.
There's a vindictiveness in the killing of Cordelia that he didn't need.
Well, someone else we haven't mentioned is the fool, and he's in it, certainly in your production, is particularly fond of her.
Yes. Yeah. No. Well, he says, he's pined away since she got sent away. So we thought that was important. We know little enough about the fool, so it's very important to use what we do know.
Yes. But Callaghan has a bleak sort of face. He's not going to be a funny man.
No. We have a very bleak vision of the fool in terms of he's really had enough, really. He can't.
Yeah.
And when Lear does what he does, he does his best to show Lear that he's done wrong, but he can't cope and goes and eventually leaves Lear and leaves him to it and maybe hangs himself. We think that's what we were talking about yesterday.
Yeah. Yes, well, when Lear takes his hat, I mean, it's, which is the madman and which the fool?
Yeah. I wanted the fool and Lear to feel like they'd known each other a long time.
Yes.
They're sort of almost contemporaries with each other, and I think they have a lovely relationship, actually. It's very...
So him calling him boy is just a term of endearment?
Yeah, because they have known each other for so long.
Yeah.
And we talked about Max Wall, that kind of, if you like, old-style British... comic, sort of seeing the world in a very sort of sardonic kind of way, and not necessarily trying to be funny, but just being sardonic, really. Yes.
Right.
That's a good word.
Right. Well, another thing perhaps we should mention is our attitudes to madness now, because people do tend now to see this play as something to do with Alzheimer's or dementia or something in a much more medical way than they used to. I mean, did you go into any of that?
We did talk about it, and I did. Obviously, it was an idea that I thought, does that explain it? But actually, he goes mad because his daughters are so horrible to him.
Yeah.
That is what does it, and he gets tipped over the edge. And so I think there are signs that he is perhaps irascible and changeable, and that could come out of his age. But I also think that what happens to him is so terrible.
Right. That he, so he's not giving up the throne because he fears that he's going mad.
I think there is a little hint that he doesn't feel he's going to last that much longer. Mm. I think he does feel that he's going to not live long.
It's not a very sensible thing to do, is it? I mean, it's an example of someone who's used to people saying yes around him, I suppose.
Yeah, nobody was challenging him. And he gets, we've made it the beginning that he gets rid of Gloucester. The one person who might have said, actually, this is not a good idea, he sends him out the room when he makes the decision. Mm. And it all goes wrong from there, really.
And then Kent gets
pushed away
as well.
Yeah.
Mm. And yet people still love him, and especially Kent.
Yes, fiercely loyal. I mean, he must have been quite a guy, I think. You know what I mean? For all his faults. A little bit like Gaddafi. I'm sure there are lots of people who will go on thinking Gaddafi was a good guy. Because, you know, they believed in him, really. And they believed...
And larger than life.
Yes. Well, you know, amazing, I suppose. He wouldn't have been... He wouldn't have survived as long as he did unless he had something about him. Mm. A sort of charisma attached to very powerful... Mm. Well, mainly men, but women as well. Mm. You know, powerful people are very charismatic. Mm. You know, I've only been in a room twice with Tony Blair, but you could feel... power of that, that he had something. Partly it's to do with the position, and
I was going to say, are they loyal to the king as king, or to Lear as king?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? But Gloucester and Kent are fiercely loyal to him, so I think that shows that he had some power of respect, you know, that he was respected, and did fight some bad battles and won and led the country, but he does then make terrible decisions, which can also happen if you stay in power too long.
Too long.
So I know when to quit.
Well, thanks very much, Ian.
You're quite welcome.